Much has been written about the great Mickey Mantle, one of the most incredible athletes to ever play Major League Baseball. And his story is a complicated one, and his legacy complicated as well. One part of his story that has probably not been sufficiently explored until now is the start of the Mickey Mantle story, his early years, his childhood, growing up, the kind of home in which he lived, and in particular, the relationship that he had with his father, who was ferociously devoted to his son and to the dream that his son should someday be able to play Major League Baseball. And that relationship is explored in an absolutely fascinating and illuminating new book called Mutt's Dream, Making the Mick. Mutt refers to the father of Mickey Mantle, Elvin Mutt Mantle. And of course, the Mick refers to Mickey Mantle himself. And Howard Berman has done an amazing job of taking us inside this this relationship, which is intriguing on all kinds of different levels. And I'm very excited to be able to speak with the author about his book, which is published by Ascend Books. Howard Berman, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I would be really curious to know what drew you to this project. That is, what about Mickey Mantle and his early years first drew you to want to explore it to this extent and to ultimately write this book?
There are a number of reasons I went down this road. One was, I've always been fascinated with the very elemental aspect of American society, fathers playing catch with their sons. It's done so often. It's often not done well. Sometimes it works brilliantly, as it did in Mickey's case. I've also realized that all of our lives, my background is in theater, so I see things from a theatrical point of view, and I think our lives, for the most part, fit into three acts. First act when we're growing up, the middle act in Mickey's case is when he was a great baseball player. The third act we know about is lechery and drunkenness and all the problems he had. But I think what sets up acts two and three is whatever happens in act one. So I thought I'd write a book about how an extraordinary life emerges from ordinary beginnings, and such was the case with Mickey Mantle.
Did you come to this, first of all, as someone deeply immersed in the world of baseball, as someone who had himself played the game and or watched it and followed it with great devotion? And to what extent were you a huge fan of Mickey Mantle before you undertook this project?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. Yeah, I grew up in New York. I grew up in Brooklyn. So I was, as all Brooklynites had to be in those days, a devoted Dodger fan. Brooklyn, as you know, was the part of New York that a lot of people thought was just working class. They weren't as important as those people who lived in Manhattan and what was going on in the rest of the city. So we were huge Dodger fans, and Duke was my guy. And I'd argue with my friends, my Dodger friends. We'd say, well, who's the greatest outfielder in baseball? Is it Willie, Mickey, or the Duke? And we always said, absolutely, no question, Duke Snider could run circles around either of those other two guys. But, you know, deep down, I thought, maybe Mickey is really better than Duke. One day, I come down for breakfast. My father's reading the paper, and he says, oh, my God, did you see what just happened? I'm 10 years old. I go, what? I thought something tragic had happened. He said, it's amazing. The Dodgers just traded Duke Snider for Mickey Mantle. And I thought, whoa, you know what? That's a good thing. That's a good deal. I like that. I really, deep down, I wouldn't admit it, but deep down I thought Mickey was the guy. And the idea of playing catch with your sons is so much a part of his background. He, as you know, he did it with his father and his uncle and his grandfather. His father pitched right-handed to him. His grandfather pitched left-handed to him. And that's part of how often young people such as myself communicate with our fathers. I didn't have a lot to talk to him about in terms of his business or what was going on in the world politics. But boy, we could talk about baseball, and that was really, really important. And that's where we met. That was our common point, was baseball, and I think it is with many people. Interestingly enough, I mentioned the three great outfielders in New York at the time, Willie, Mickey, and the Duke. All three of them had dominant fathers who played the game and taught that to their sons. My father pitched to me till his arm fell off. My career, however, was a little bit short of Mickey Mantle's. Actually, it was even short of making the high school team, but that's another story.
So I want to, before we explore further the story of Mickey Mantle, I want to ask you a couple of questions about how this book is written. First of all, one of the choices that you made that I think is a really good choice is that this book is written in the present tense versus the past tense. And I'm curious, I have my own theory, but I want to ask you first if you had a particular reason for writing this book in present tense.
Yeah, I sure did. And, a lot of people think, a lot of writers will say, no, you can't write in the first tense. It must be in present tense. It must be in the past tense. But more and more, that's going away. We're seeing people like Hilary Mantel and others who are brilliant writers writing in the present tense. So I thought, the door sort of opened to be able to do that. But more than that is I'm a playwright. I've written over 30 plays. And I see things on stage. I can picture what's happening. And so I think by putting it in the present tense, it makes it more immediate. It makes it more like a film, if you will, or a play that takes place in the present tense. And that's what I wanted. That's how I wanted it to read. What I do best as a writer, I think, is dialogue, and I can put that in the present tense situation and try to make it work from that perspective. It's interesting. At one point in the book, I said, in their room, in their house, watching baseball on the radio. And the publishers came along and said, no, we changed that to, you miswrote, you really meant he's listening to that on the radio. And I said, no, I meant he's watching it on the radio, because I think baseball is a sport that those of us who know it, we can picture what's going on. You listen to hockey on the radio or something, and I really don't have a clue about where all the players are and what's happening. I know where the players are on a baseball field, and I know when they're describing that what's happening. So I think we see baseball in the present tense, even when we're listening to it. And I think by putting it in the present tense, it makes it more immediate, more like we're watching a film or a television show.
That's a great explanation. That's better than my theory. My theory was that because this book focuses on Mickey Mantle's early years, I mean his early childhood through his adolescence, essentially, that so often children live entirely in the present moment. So that was my little private theory that's why this book was written in the present tense. But I think drawing it to your own background as a playwright, that makes even more sense. At any rate, I think it's a great choice. The other thing I wanted to ask you about, you've already touched on, is that you love crafting dialogue, as of course you have to do, and as you've done for your many plays. Your book is full of rich, illuminating dialogue. But, of course, in many cases, in just about every case, we're talking about dialogue that no one was there to overhear. In other words, this is dialogue created entirely from your own imagination, but deeply rooted in these people and who they were. Tell us more about the process of crafting dialogue and making it authentic and realistic, even though there is no way in which this dialogue can be a literal quotation of conversations that actually took place.
Yeah, absolutely right. It's something I've often done in my books, and I like doing it, and that is you create dialogue, but never, ever does it violate what we know to be true or factual. So, for example, if we know that, let's take a scene where Mickey is standing on the edge of the river with his buddies. They're three good buddies, Bill Moseley, Leroy Bennett, and Nick Ferguson. And they go swimming sometimes in the river that went nearby. And we know, for example, at one point, and Mickey couldn't swim, by the way, interestingly enough. His buddies could. He never learned to swim. I guess he wasn't a good enough athlete. I don't know. But he couldn't swim for whatever reason, and he's standing on the side of the river, as they all were, had the clothes off. They were swimming in the buff, of course. And a girl comes by, and he jumps a mile. They all did, and he jumps into the river, and he can't swim, and he's flailing away. And his buddy, Leroy Bennett, comes and pulls him out of the water. Well, we know that's exactly what happened. We don't know exactly what he said, but it's easy to project that he might have said something like, "Geez, there's a girl over there, watch it." And dives in the water, and Bill Moseley comes over and says, "Come on, Mickey, I'm going to pull you out." So I create that dialogue, but it's always, we know what happened. We know the situation. We just take some dialogue to get there. So, for example, if we know that A happened and C happened, well, we create what happens in B to get from A to C. I'll get to some other stories later if you want, but what I take as the basis for that is an old statement by my playwriting teacher. He said, imagination is the invention is the springboard of the imagination. We imagine things, and then we spring from that and we create something to make that happen. So the dialogue never violates what we know. I didn't write dialogue and have Mickey say, "Hey, let's go down and rob the grocery store or something." I mean, things that didn't happen, there's no dialogue like that. Only the dialogue that fits the scene that we know to be true, or at least the people there said it was true. So that's the invented dialogue.
Right.
And it also brings the characters to life.
Absolutely.
It's more interesting to listen to a character than to describe the character.
Right. I think it works beautifully. Some of my favorite dialogue in the book, actually, occurs between Mutt, that's Mickey Mantle's father, and a friend of his named Ox. And those conversations are often some of the most revelatory in terms of us understanding what was driving Mickey Mantle's father to drive his own son so relentlessly when it came to baseball. And this friend or acquaintance of Mutt challenges him on many occasions in terms of his motivation and so on. And those conversations show us a lot. I appreciate that they're here.
Yeah, actually, Mutt is a made-up character. He's the only made-up character in the entire book. And I just use him to represent all of Mutt's buddies. And we know they were telling him things about, "You're pushing your son too hard." Mutt would talk about that sometimes. And Mickey talked about it in some of the things that he wrote. People would say, "Oh, Mutt, you're pushing your son. He can't do that. You're gonna ruin him." And Mutt would come back and say, "No, I know what I'm doing. I understand baseball, and I understand what I can give my son. And what I can give my son, I only know how to do two things. I only know how to mine and play baseball. I don't want him in the mine. I'd rather he play baseball." So, yeah, that dialogue is invented, but it reflects the things that we know Mutt said and did.
Absolutely. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Howard Berman about his book, Mutt's Dream, Making the Mick. The book focuses on the early years of Mickey Mantle and the ways in which Mickey Mantle's father, Elvin Mutt Mantle, relentlessly worked his son, Mickey, to become the very best baseball player that he could possibly be. This story plays out basically during the Great Depression and into a part of the country that was especially hard hit. That's a significant backdrop. Tell our listeners more about the impoverished circumstances of Mickey Mantle's childhood, and to whatever extent this is a serious theme in the Mantle household and in the shaping of Mickey Mantle.
Yeah, it's a very serious theme, and I think that if we look at the threads of his unsettled adult life, if we look at Mickey's athletic feats, if we look at his persona, both the real and the claimed persona, and but those things about him that were said that were mythic, some were true, the idea of the rube, the legend, the drunkard, I think all of that can be found on the alkali fields, in the chat piles, in the parched earth of rural Oklahoma where he grew up. It was a difficult place. There's no question about it. It was dry. It was windy. It was depressed. There wasn't a lot that somebody could do there other than work in the mine or perhaps become a tenant farmer. And for a while, Muck tried to be a tenant farmer, and it didn't work out real well, and the ground wasn't very good for growing crops, and even if you did grow crops, you ended up giving half of the money you made or more to the person who owned the farm. So it was a difficult, difficult situation. What worked was working in the mines. That's how you could make a living. But it was dangerous work. People were injured and hurt all the time. Lovell, his wife, often says, we listened to the sirens all day coming to and from the mine. People were injured. And, of course, often they died from lung disease, as we know happened to Mickey's father and several of his uncles. So it was a difficult place. It was a depressed place. It was dry and dusty. And for much of Mickey's upbringing, they moved a number of times, from Spavinaw to Pitcher to White House to Commerce, back and forth. But in a number of these houses, they had no indoor plumbing. They had no real heating. Mickey would talk about having to get up in the mornings and start the fire as one of his duties in the household so that it would be warm enough for the rest of the family. It was a depressed area. The whole thing, when you looked out over the landscape, they had these giant piles called chat piles. And chat was the residue from the zinc and lead mines. And that's what Mud was, a zinc and lead miner. And these chat piles would be higher than houses, 2, 3, 4, 5-story houses, these giant piles of chat. But the ground itself was all alkali. It was a result of the dust and stuff coming up from the lead and the zinc. These were dangerous alkali fields. They had pits in them that were left over from other mine shafts that would go down. And Mickey's mother was panic-stricken that while the boys were playing it out in the alkali fields, they might fall down and get injured in one of these giant holes. So it was not a prosperous area. I know it's easy to sort of say it's a cliche, rags to riches sort of situation, but in this case, it was rags to riches.
And I think what's really important about understanding this backdrop of the Great Depression and this world, which in your words was cheerless and drab, spiritually void, and forever mired in dusty gloom, that helps us then understand the place of baseball in this. You write, to Mutt and many like him, baseball is the great escape. They call it the national pastime for a reason. It provides diversion and a summertime remedy to the pervading feeling of hopelessness. It offers hope, always. No matter how poorly a team or player is playing, there is always hope that in tomorrow's game, things will be better. The team will win. The player will break out of a slump. This is Mutt's faith. Tell us briefly about Mutt's own relationship to the game of baseball. What kind of a baseball player was he, and what kind of know-how did he bring to the task of shaping his son, Mickey, to be a baseball player himself?
He played a lot. He played on semi-pro teams, semi-pro meaning maybe they pass the hat and you get a few bucks at the end of a game, and he wasn't paid a salary per se. But he played on many semi-pro teams and amateur teams all over the area, as his father did, Mickey's grandfather, Charlie, and played the game, he always claimed, the right way. Now, I know sons are often saying, oh, my father was a much better player than I was. I'll never be as good as my father. And maybe that's what we say when we're younger and we look up and we see a much better player in your father. Whether that was really true or not, I don't know. I found a few quotes from people during the time who said, yeah, Mutt was a great player, could have been better than Mickey. Others said, nah, that's not really true. He was a good player. He was a solid player. But he did know the game. He studied the game. He knew how to play it well. He certainly knew about hitting, although later a lot of people would be critical of Mutt, saying he never really thought Mickey to be the fielder that Mickey might have been. Mutt wanted Mickey to be a catcher for one particular reason. He loved Mickey Cochran, who was then with Philadelphia. Mickey was a tough guy and played through injuries and pain and was just a role model for Mutt. And so Mickey is named after Mickey Cochran. Mickey Mantle is named after Mickey Cochran. By the way, he said later, I never knew it was Mickey Cochran's real name was Gordon. It's a damn good thing it wasn't called Gordon. And, you know, it's sort of ironic in a way when you think about it, because part, not a big part, but a little part of Mickey's persona is the name, Mickey Mantle. It really kind of rolls off the tongue. It sounds like it could be somebody important, Mickey Mantle, but Gordon Mantle doesn't quite have the same.
Not quite the same. I want to.
Not quite the same ring at all.
Absolutely. I want to read what you write in the book about why Mutt loved this position of catcher so much and why that was his first and foremost dream for Mickey. This is what you write. Mutt has always favored catching because he sees the position as being in the center of everything, the most important man on the field. From his squatting position behind the plate, the catcher scans the entire field. He tells the pitcher what kind of pitch he wants. He calls out to infielders to tell them who should take a high pop-up when two or more are coming together. He signals to everyone how many outs there are. And he must be tough. Tipped fast pitches will come back and nail him. All manners of wild pitches will come and strike him. Black and blue marks, broken fingers, and sore knees from constant squatting come with the position. Battering and bruising are to be expected. Only hard men put on the catching gear. Mutt is a hard man. Catchers also need to be among the most skillful players. They must have lightning-fast reflexes, great hands, a powerful and accurate throwing arm. Few players can claim such a troika of skills. Mutt has them, and he is determined Mickey will learn them. I really love that, because if one is a really casual observer of the game, you tend not to see any of that in terms of the intricacies that are involved in the position of catcher.
Yeah, I think that's true. It's interesting with Mickey because he was catching in his early days when playing ball, as you know, but he was tiny. He was really small. And they would talk about, oh, Mickey looks like a turtle with his head sticking out from behind the chest protector, from the catcher's chest protector. So Mutt was a little disappointed when Mickey couldn't go on with his catching duties, and they made him, of course, at first an infielder, and then in high school he was a pitcher.
Tell our listeners about the kind of workouts that occurred between father and son in the early years. And maybe we should even start with what Mutt began to do when Mickey was still in a crib. Were those very, very first baseball exploits like?
This was Mutt's dream. And it was Mutt's dream before Mickey was born. He decided, do this with my son. His dream was, baseball can get you out of the mine, and you don't want to work in these mines. Believe me, it's not a place to go. You got to get out of these mines. So he made that determination from day one. And early on, he would lob a ball into the crib with the baby Mickey in there, and Mickey's mother would have a fit and try to hide the balls around the house someplace, and Mutt would often find it. And then, I'm not sure if I wrote about this in the book or not, but I know at one point she made up a ball made out of yarn, a big yarn, puffy yarn ball, and said, "Well, throw that. At least it's not going to hurt the kid." So Mutt was absolutely determined that Mickey was going to know what a baseball was. He was going to know what it was physically. He was going to know what it was inherently. It's going to be part of his psyche, if you will, as he grows up, because a baseball is going to be in his crib, and it's always going to be there. When he started then pitching to Mickey and trying to teach Mickey to hit, as we all know, he wanted Mickey to be a switch hitter. And he was way ahead of his time. People were doing that a lot in those days, the idea of lefties batting against righties and righties against lefties. The platoon idea wasn't a big deal in those days. But Mutt could see it coming. He said, it's the way it's going to go, and you're going to be ahead of the game if you do that. And as an added bonus, when Mickey got a little bit older, was the fact that when he was batting from the left side, he could get down to first base a lot faster, and he was a sprinter. We sometimes forget that. We think of the power of Mickey, but we forget how incredibly fast he was as a runner as well. So Mutt and Charlie, Mutt's father, pitched to Mickey incessantly every day. Mickey would come home from school and wait for his father, and when his father got out of the mine, they would bat against this old tin barn, really a tin garage that they had in the backyard. Mutt would throw right-handed, Charlie would throw left-handed, and it was pitch after pitch after pitch after pitch for days, for weeks, for years.
One of the things you tell us is that this matter of Mickey hitting from both sides, left-handed and right-handed hitting, this became, in a sense, kind of a bone of contention or a source of tension once in a while between father and son, who in so many other ways were incredibly close and in sync. Not always when it came to this. Explain why Mickey was, at least from time to time, resistant to this notion of hitting on both sides and why there was a little bit of difference of opinion between father and son.
Yeah, I think the answer is actually relatively simple. Mickey couldn't do it as well left-handed. He had trouble with it initially. He was terrible. He would cry and carry on. I can't do this. What are you making me hit left-handed for? And, you know, in life, we tend to do and like to do what we do best. And what Mickey did best was hit right-handed in those days. And he really rebelled against having to hit left-handed all the time. But his father insisted. He said, nope, you're going to do it today. You're going to take X number of balls today left-handed. Of course, Mickey goes on to be very arguably the greatest switch-hitting player who's ever played baseball. It did him. His father was right about that. It turned out really well for Mickey, but it was tough. It's not easy to bat left-handed when you're naturally a right-handed person.
Another interesting switch that ends up occurring is when Mickey, as a youngster, as I think he was 11 years old at the time, is able to become part of the Pitcher Junior Cardinal League team, even though he's actually a year younger than he is supposed to be. Coach Gantner does not think that Mickey should be a catcher. Explain why he wants young Mickey to play a different position, and who ultimately won this struggle between coach and father. It's a really interesting moment in the story, I think.
Yes. Well, what he says is that Mickey's going to get hurt. He's too small. That you want a burly catcher, the guy that doesn't run really well. And Mickey ran well. So he thought, we're wasting his speed having him be behind the plate. He needs to be in the infield. And so he pushed him. And Mutt didn't want this at all. I mean, Mutt was absolutely dead against it. But he also saw that there was some value in the idea that Mickey had speed. And so he moved him to shortstop. As it turns out, he wasn't a particularly great shortstop. He had a terrific arm, but with a scatter arm often when he threw to first base. He never really took to it like he should have. And even many years later, when he went to the Yankees, he went up as a shortstop. And Casey Stengel took one look at him and said, hey, kid, go out to the outfield and catch some balls. It didn't work for him to do that. But Mutt was disappointed when Mickey couldn't be the catcher anymore. But it worked out well in the long run, didn't it?
Absolutely. This is how you write it. After Gantner explains his reasoning, Mutt reluctantly agrees to let Mickey play second as a trial, but insists that if Mickey isn't good there, Gantner will return him to catcher, or Mutt will pull him from the team. Despite his protestations, Mutt realizes the coach is right. At second, Mickey can better showcase his talents. Still, he is a little disappointed. His dream always had Mickey behind the plate. From Mickey Cochran to Mickey Mantle seemed right to him. A catcher is like the quarterback of the team. He sees everything. He controls play. He is the team's heart and soul. Mutt had long considered this Mickey's baseball destiny. Now he will have to edit his dream. For those of you just joining us.
Of course, should have been second base, sorry.
Right. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Howard Berman about his book, Mutt's Dream, Making the Mick. I think it's really important at this point to add a note of clarification about the way in which Mutt pushed his son, Mickey, when it came to his to baseball exploits. I think it's really interesting and tempting to think of this in the most negative of terms, when in fact there is actually a little bit of nuance to the way that Mutt went about doing this with Mickey. I mean that there are ways in which he did not push Mickey too much in the way that other fathers in this position often do. there are a number of different ways, and one of them is that Mickey says later that his father never pushed him to win. It was never about winning. Explain what this was about, if it wasn't about winning.
Yeah, you bring up a really good point, and I think, you know, the easiest thing to say is, well, Mickey became a great player, we know that, and we know his father really pushed him, therefore it was a negative situation, and Mickey resented it, and the problems he had later in life were a result of his father pushing him. I don't think that's true. I couldn't find any evidence to suggest that Mickey didn't go along with what his father wanted him to do. As you indicated, we know some other stories, Todd Marinovich and Marv Marinovich, and that was a toxic situation with Tiger Woods and Earl Woods. I don't know if that was a toxic situation or not. But the thing with Mickey is all of his life, he wanted his father to respect him. And the only way his father, he knew to do that was to play baseball really well. And so the relationship between father and sons was a good one. Oh, I'm sure they had their moments. I'm sure there were days when they, as kids always do, argue with their parents. But when you take the whole arc of the situation, it was a good relationship. Hmm. Mutt, I think it's absolutely accurate. It wasn't about winning, Mickey. It's about doing your best. If you always play your best, then good things are going to happen. And after he'd tell Mickey after every game, when you come off the field, ask yourself, is there something that you didn't do that you should have? I'm not talking about a mistake. You drop a ball, you drop a ball. That's not an issue. But should you have been someplace else at that time? Should you have made a different, taken a different route to the ball? Those are the things that Mutt emphasized. Winning, yes, but playing the game to the best of your ability is absolutely less critical.
Hmm. The other thing about this relationship is that that Mutt is really interested in Mickey understanding the details and nuances of this wonderful game. And I think you describe that so beautifully as you describe the scene when Mutt takes young Mickey to his first St. Louis Cardinals game. It's the first time Mickey Mantle is in a major league ballpark. And, you know, Mutt is pointing out all kinds of things that Mickey should be watching for. And at this point, Mutt says, it's a good lesson for you watching the great ones. Now, what I want you to pay particular attention to are the details. That's what baseball is, really. It's the little details that make all the difference. How an outfielder shades his eyes from the sun. How a batter adjusts in the batter's box according to how the pitcher is throwing. How the shortstop moves a foot or two depending on how the pitcher is throwing to a particular batter. It's the details that make the greatest players. Most fans, they don't see none of that. But we're not most fans because we see those kind of things. It's just a wonderful exchange that helps us understand that this is not just about a bully father pushing his young son too hard, but a father trying to introduce his son to all of the various shades and levels of this great game.
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting that later in his life, Mickey sort of played the part that people expected him to play a little bit, the rube from rural Oklahoma, and maybe not the brightest guy in the world. He was smart, by the way, or at least he got very good grades in school, and he was on the pre-engineering club and stuff. So there's nothing to suggest that he wasn't bright. But Mickey, at one point later in his life, said, sometimes I think if I had the same body and the same natural ability as somebody else with somebody else's brain, who knows how good a player I could have been. The only thing I can do is play baseball. I have to play baseball. It's the only thing I know. So he kind of put aside the fact that he did study all these finer aspects of baseball and sort of implied, oh, I'm just a big kid who plays the game, and when somebody throws the ball hard, I try to swing hard. That's not really true. He did know the game very well because Mudd insisted that he do.
Hmm. One bone of contention between father and son is about the matter of Mickey being permitted to play other sports, more specifically basketball and football. And these are things that Mickey very much wants to do, and his father is rather against it, not excited about the basketball, and adamantly opposed to Mickey playing football. And, of course, this comes at a back in a time when I think the prevailing wisdom was often that, if you're good at a sport, focus on that. And now I think more people understand that playing a variety of sports can actually be the very best thing for a young athlete. What kind of a difference do you think it made in the shaping of Mickey Mantle that ultimately he did play some basketball and some football and pretty darn well?
I think a number of things that come up with that. One was his friends were playing those games, and so he wanted to be part of the group of his friends, and that's important when you're growing up. You can't be alienated from your friends, and he wasn't because of this. Also, the school came to Mickey and said, you owe it to us to play football. We're in the part of the world where football is king, not baseball. It's football. You've got to play football for us. And Mutt, as you know, didn't want any part of that. He felt Mickey was likely to get hurt, as Mickey did, in fact, get hurt. He'd rather just stay with baseball. The fact is, he was a pretty good all-around athlete, not surprising that. He was a guard on the basketball team, and a pretty good one. And he was an excellent running back. They called halfbacks, I guess, in those days. Led the conference in rushing yards, and even went to the University of Oklahoma, met with Bud Wilkinson, or met with the Del Royal, who was the quarterback under Wilkinson. Whether Mickey was ever actually offered a scholarship, I don't know. There's stories that say yes and stories that say he wasn't actually ever offered a scholarship. But he was a good football player. And then, of course, came the injury playing football.
Mm. It's a really serious injury to one of his legs, and it leads to a long period of hospitalization. Just explain to our listeners how serious an injury this was and how drastically and irreversibly Mickey Mantle's life was nearly changed by this injury.
Yeah, first or second day of practice, he's kicked in the ankle by Bill Moseley, his good buddy, obviously on accident, while they were running a play. He didn't think too much of it at the time. He limped to the sidelines. Somebody took him to a house and put his leg up and said, okay, the swelling will go down, not a problem. Turns out it was a problem. It was a real big problem. It turned into osteomyelitis, which can be extremely dangerous. They eventually have to take him to the Crippled Children's Hospital in Oklahoma City. They didn't want to do that initially because they didn't have the money to go to a private hospital, and they felt it was demeaning to go to a public hospital. But anyway, they take him into the hospital, and the doctors had, fortunately, a new medicine, and it really was new at the time, and not very many hospitals had it. So Mickey was extremely fortunate that the particular hospital in Oklahoma City had the medicine. It was called penicillin. And the doctor started treating the leg with penicillin. And how many shots he got over the time that he was being treated, I don't know, but it was maybe hundreds. They just filled him up with penicillin, like you can't believe. He was hospitalized 3 or 4 different times. They thought it was getting better. It wasn't. And at one point, they call in Mutt and Mutt's wife, Mickey's mother, Lavelle, and say, if this doesn't get better, we only have one choice here. We're going to have to take the leg off. Well, Mutt was devastated, needless to say. But Lovell, who was a firecracker to begin with, she stood up and she said, you ain't taking that leg off now. You're not taking it off tomorrow, and you ain't taking it off next week. If you can't fix Mickey here, we'll go someplace else. You're not taking the leg off. And of course, we know they ultimately didn't take the leg off. But that was part of the problem that he had with injuries when he got up with the Yankees. It was the same leg. It was the knee in that leg that created all the problems. So Mickey's much dream almost came to a screeching halt that day when Mickey played football and got osteomyelitis.
Hmm. It's a little bit amazing that Mickey ultimately played some more football after that. That took some courage, and it's amazing that his father allowed him to do that. We have not yet touched on something that we can only talk very briefly about, and that is the fact that at one point very early in his childhood, regrettably, Mickey was, I guess we would say, sexually assaulted by his half-sister, Anna B. This is so hard to read about. And I wonder, you know, we'll mostly leave it to our listeners to explore that. I'm sure it was not easy for you to write these passages from the book. Can you just say a word about what you believe to be the lasting ramifications of Mickey having experienced this as a youngster?
Mickey was inherently shy. He was a shy young man. He was a nice young man. His teachers and his friends all said he was a really good kid. But he was reserved, and he was shy, and he was anxious. He was not good around girls. He wet his bed until he was much older. And then there was this incredible incident where Anna B. and her girlfriends made him drop his pants and play with his private parts. And I think that probably had something to do with Mickey's relationship with women that occurred later on. I know that's sort of pop psychology, and I can't say that it's the case for sure, but it's very likely that that affected him all of his life, that there was always this thing about women, and we know he became a womanizer. He was terrible with Merlin, his wife, and Mickey seeing lots of other women and having difficulties in that relationship. Probably there's some seed of that in the incident when he was molested. Of course, he never talked about it. He didn't talk about that. You're not going to go to your friends and say, guess what happened to me yesterday? You'll never believe what Anna B. did to me. So he hid it. And that had to be part of the insecurity and the vulnerability that he always had.
Hmm. There is also this sense of doom that hung over Mickey Mantle, this sense that he was perhaps destined to die young, because so many men in the Mantle family had died young. To what extent did this shape who he was and how he approached life as an adult?
Huge. I think it absolutely dominated his adult life. He runs into Billy Martin and Whitey Ford, and they're drinkers, and he became a drinker. He never took care of himself the way he should have in later life. I'm talking mostly after baseball now. He's quoted as saying, and it's probably not an original saying with him, but he repeated it a number of times. He said, if I'd known I was going to live this long, I would have taken better care of himself. I think clearly that was a sort of Damocles hanging over his head, that he really did think that he wouldn't live long. Why should he? Nobody in his family, none of the men, or almost none of the men in his family, his uncles, his father, his grandfather, died young. And, of course, the great tragedy in Mickey's situation is Mutt's dream to make Mickey a great baseball player. Mutt never saw it. He died right after Mickey came up to the majors, so he never saw that dream come true. Mickey figured he'd die in his late 40s.
Hmm. One of the most touching moments in the book is when there is this statement made really again and again that Mickey is Mutt's best friend, and that as Mickey grows up, there is a sense that Mutt is losing his best friend. At one point, say this as Mickey has just signed his contract. He is a professional baseball player. It is justification of everything Mutt has wanted, but it is bittersweet, too. Soon Mickey will be off to whatever his future holds. It is difficult for Mutt to imagine his life without Mickey. Mutt is both contented and melancholy. His best friend is leaving. What could possibly fill the void? I'd never really stopped to think about what that would mean with a father and son who have this kind of relationship.
His entire life was wrapped around Mickey, and now Mickey was gone. Yeah, it's a difficult thing to deal with. And Mark didn't have to, of course, because he died shortly thereafter.
Mm. Well, the story is so poignant and fascinating on so many different levels. And even if one is not a huge baseball fan or a Yankees fan or a Mickey Mantle fan, there is just so much, nevertheless, to explore in this book that I just think makes it endlessly interesting. The book is again titled Mutt's Dream, Making the Mick, published by Ascend Books and the author Howard Berman. Howard Berman, I congratulate you on crafting a really wonderful book. I loved it start to finish, and I'm so glad that we could have this conversation about it. Thank you so much, and best wishes.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.